Dr. Charlie Bamforth joins me this week to discuss flavors and yeast. This is Beersmith Podcast number 164.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit Beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 164, and it's late January 2018. Charlie Bamforth joins me to discuss the flavors that come from yeast. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They have a great online learning platform at learn.beerandbrewing.com, where you can take a wide variety of online courses in brewing. Also, the offer code BEERSMITH2017 gives you 20% off when you sign up for any of their online courses. Learn more about brewing at learn.beerandbrewing.com. And also the new BrewVision thermometer from Blickman Engineering. This interactive wireless digital thermometer connects right to your iPhone or iPad and lets you remotely monitor your record temperatures. You can download your recipes right from the Beersmith Cloud and set updates and alerts while you brew. Get the BrewVision Bluetooth thermometer today, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith Software, the industry standard for home and professional brewers. It lets you design great beer recipes and brew with confidence. Download your free 21-day trial from Beersmith.com today. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Dr. Charlie Bamforth. He's professor of malting and brewing science at the University of California at Davis. Charlie specializes in the study of wholesomeness of beer, including beer perception, polyphenols, foam stability, oxidation, and flavor stability. This is actually Charlie's ninth time on the podcast, and he's one of my favorite guests. Charlie, it is great to have you back on the show.
Thanks, Brad. It's nice to be here. I always enjoy it, so it's good to speak to you.
Number nine, I think you're the only guest that's been on the show more than I have, actually.
Oh, my.
Or as much as except for me, I guess. I've been on 164 episodes so far.
All right. Well, that's okay.
You got a little catching up to do.
It's... Well, it's your baby, not mine, but nine times.
Nine times, yeah.
I'll probably run out of things to talk about now, haven't I?
No, not at all. It's great to have you back on the show. What have you been up to as you've been, I think you've been preparing for your semi-retirement, right? Is that your latest project?
My wife thinks it's my full retirement. So technically speaking, it's full retirement, but you'll still hear bits and pieces of me. So I retire at the end of the year, and we're looking for my replacement right now. We've got some interesting candidates, and but I'm still busy doing lots of other things. Just submitted to the American Society of Brewing Chemists the fourth. Text for the fourth book in the series on quality. So the next one's on color and clarity. Two more of those to go. We're actually, I'm actually recording those, that material, as classes, online classes as part of UC Extension. So we're hoping to launch that this year. And so people can do a class on foam and flavor and freshness, and then color and clarity, and then the two remaining books in the series. So each class matches up with one of the books. Busy doing a few other book projects, and looking forward to teaching summer abroad again in Nottingham, England, during the month of July. It's the third time we've done that. So just in case there's anybody out there listening to this who are fully paid up student members on a campus somewhere in the States, take a look at it, go to my website and follow the link through to UC Summer Abroad, Study Abroad, and come study with me in Nottingham, England. It's a lot of fun.
And that's University of California, Davis, right? Brewing program.
It is the UC Davis Brewing Program, but I teach the class for the whole of the month of July, and we base ourselves in the University of Nottingham, but we have four field trips. The first week we go to a malt house, Muntons, up in the northeast of England. Second week we'll be going to the Elgood's Brewery in Cambridgeshire. The third week we'll be going to a hop yard in Hereford and Worcester. And the fourth week we go to Murphy's, which is in Nottingham, and that's where they make the Isinglass finings for the brewing industry. So it's a lot of fun. I really enjoy doing it, and we got a lot of passionate students, and yeah, it's a great way to study brewing.
I'm trying to remember, is that where you're from? Where are you from?
Yeah. I'm from just outside Wigan in northwest Lancashire, so I'm from halfway between Manchester and Liverpool. But I am actually a visiting professor at the University of Nottingham, but this class is quite separate from Nottingham. It just happens to be located on the main campus in Nottingham.
And of course, today we were going to focus on one of your other books, which is on yeast and flavors. And yep. I was actually doing a presentation on the off flavors or troubleshooting, and I noted that out of the BJCP off flavors, the one on the BJCP judging sheet that people use to judge beer, something like 10 of the 16 that they list are potential yeast problems.
Right. Yeah. Well, that doesn't surprise me. You know, most of the brewing professors on the planet, their specialty is yeast. I'm the guy who worries much more about malt and beer quality, but I love to tease the yeast guys, saying, you know, at the end of the day, it's just a convenient way to make alcohol. But of course, I am exaggerating. So the yeast is very important, and it sure can screw things up if you get it wrong.
And you sent me some excerpts from your ASBC book, the handbook that you wrote on beer flavor. And in chapter 5, you cover the major flavor contributors. And I just thought we'd walk through some of them today, and it'd be an interesting episode. Let's start with sourness. Sourness in beer.
Yeah. Why would you start with sourness? I mean, anyway, there we go.
Well, usually my beer ends with sourness, so, you know. Seems reasonable.
Yeah, it is. Of course, it's one of the main four classic tastes of beer: sweet, salt, sour, and bitter. And of course, sourness means different things to different people. Sour is, you know, all beers are sour to a certain extent. The vast majority of beers are in the pH range 4 to 4.5. And of course, sourness is a measure of acidity. So the more acid something is, the more sour it is. And as I say, most beers are in the 4 to 4.5 region, which is fairly sour, not as sour as lemon juice, but sour enough. But for a lot of people, when they talk sour, they're thinking sour beers. You know, they're talking the real, really acidic products that are dependent on the action of acid-forming bacteria. So we got to differentiate between them in terms of the sourness that for the regular beer and the sourness that's generated from the yeast. Then there are a number of things that are going to influence it. One is the wort. To what extent does that wort hold the pH constant? You know, there are buffers in wort that tend to keep the pH in the sort of the mid fives, but as they are used up by the yeast. That contributes to the ability of the pH to be lowered, as well as the fact that the yeast actually does release acid.
Mm-hmm. So the pH generally goes down as it ferments, right?
Yeah, it goes down from the mid-fives down to the mid to low fours. And that is, as I say, a combination of the fact that the yeast is releasing acid, but also you're losing these buffering materials, things like peptides and small proteins and possibly one or two of the amino acids. And they're going down, and therefore the buffering capacity lowers as well. So if you've got a wort that has got less buffering capacity, you know, less, say, malt in it, then it will tend to allow the pH to drop that little bit more. And of course, the vigor of the yeast, the vigor of the fermentation, the extent of the fermentation is also going to influence the pH drop. So if you've got a more extensive fermentation, the pH is going to lower to a greater extent. Of course, the other thing you can do to adjust pH is add acids. And also, if you're not having acids, things like calcium, they drop the pH of the wort because the calcium reacts with things like phosphate and possibly proteins, and they release acid. By acid, I'm referring, of course, to the hydrogen ion. And so the more calcium, the lower the pH.
So I assume the starting water profile plays a big role as well, doesn't it?
It does. And so brewers, of course, talk about residual alkalinity. Mm-hmm. Which is contributed by bicarbonate. So the more bicarbonate in the water, the higher the pH is going to be because that's an alkali. And that's balanced with the level of calcium and magnesium. So the more calcium and to a lesser extent magnesium, the more you're going to sort of acidify things and lower the pH. So you, in any textbook worth its salt, you can see an equation for residual alkalinity. And, you know, that's very much governed by the water, whether it's fairly hard water, and if so, is it temporary hard or permanent hardness and so on.
So does a residual alkalinity kind of give us a measure of how easy it is to move the pH then?
Yes, it's a clue. It's a clue. The other thing, of course, you can test is the buffering capacity, which is of any wort or beer, which is, you know, if you sort of titrate with acid, you know, how much do you need to shift the pH? And the more of these buffering materials are present, the more they're going to resist this this pH change. Now, of course, the other thing that people talk about is other sour beers and deliberately trying to get more sour beers. And of course, then you're dependent on acid forming bacteria to a large extent, typically, you know, the lactic acid bacteria. And so, you know, for some people, it's a case of using those early on. You know, people talk about kettle souring and things like this. So introducing the acidity upstream, or of course, you know, for the classic sort of lambic beers and the, you know, to use Vinnie Chalerzo's own words, these funky beers, then of course it's acid-forming bacteria later as well in the formation of sort of the spontaneously fermented ales and so on. Interesting piece of work we've done recently, Brad, has been with an organism called La Chancia. It was a student of mine called Jen House. She showed that, you know, by using this organism, La Chancia, it can carry out the primary fermentation of beer, but it also releases more acid than Saccharomyces. So using something like La Chancia, you can actually ferment and sour with the same organism. And we published that in the pages of the Journal of the Institute of Brewing.
Interesting. Is that quicker as well? And does it produce lactic acid or some other kind of acid?
It does. It does produce lactic acid. And it's not going to give you quite the intensity of sourness as lactic acid bacteria. But it you know, the beauty of it is it's fermentation and souring in with the use of one organism. The guys over in John Shepherd's laboratory over in North Carolina, they made a big splash about this. It was on PBS when they talked about this organism that came from, I think it was wasps or something, that was seeding beers. That organism was La Chancia, and I'm very grateful that they recognized the fact that it was actually House and the rest of us here in Davis that first published that work on La Chancia in beer. So interesting.
I had a question. I was brewing with a group out in Colorado, and they were playing with adding lactic acid directly to the wort itself before fermentation. I thought it was a little dicey because you're really lowering the pH quite a bit. But
you are, because, I mean, you've got to remember that for any of the things we're going to talk about today, you change one parameter in the interest of controlling a certain flavor, whether it's sourness or whatever. And if you change it with the aim of in this case, changing sourness, if you're not careful, you're going to influence other things. So you change the pH, That's going to influence other things. It's going to influence bitterness extraction upstream. It's going to influence yeast flocculation, possibly. It's going to influence lots of different things.
Yeah, I know from making wines and meads, if you get the pH low enough, it starts to inhibit fermentation too.
Yeah, yeah. So you've got to do these things mindfully. And it's like I said to all of the students in my classes, you know, when you set up your process for your beer, the beer in question, that's when you need to get it all perfected. And then once you've identified, I'm going to do all of these things, and that will give me the beer I want. Then, for goodness sake, keep those conditions constant. You don't start tinkering, because if you tinker with one thing, you're going to throw something else out of kilter and out of balance if you're not careful. So you know, it's great time for experimentation. If you want to make a brand new beer, you know, in the case of sourness, it may be a Gosa, something like that, with the saltiness as well. But you know, once you've hit upon the process and the raw materials that you want to give you a certain beer, then, well, that should be it, and strive to make it that same way every time.
Yeah, it was interesting. We had, on the last show, we had John Blickman and Chris White from White Labs on, and they had been doing some experiments with pressure fermentation and found out that it actually changed the bitterness level, which you might not obviously expect, for example.
Which you might not. And also, the other thing to say for many of these things is, you know, people interpret, well, that's probably for this reason. And it might be for some entirely different reason. You know, people make conclusions about why something does something, but often you find for these experiential observations, there may be two or three different explanations for why it's happening, you know? And they're not always entirely predictable. So there's a lot to be said for you know, understanding your system, understanding what your system is capable of doing, and as I say, using that same process time in, time out. And of course, it often bites brewers in the backside when they, you know, they intent on taking over the world. They go and buy another brewery and they try to make a certain beer in a different configuration of brewery, and you know, it's a very lousy match because all sorts of things come into play. So when you talk about yeast, you're not talking about just the yeast strain, you're talking about all the fermentation conditions, and very much the shape and the size of the fermenter has got a huge role to play in what the yeast will or will not belt out.
Right. Yeah. When we talked last week about pressure fermentation, they were talking about even just tall fermenters, you can easily reach, you know, 1 or 2 atmospheres pressure at the bottom of the fermenter, you know.
So yeah, and if a yeast is subjected to pressure, like anything else that's subjected to pressure, it tends to react in interesting ways.
Well, moving on to your book, you also cover VDKs, which a lot of people may not be familiar with that term, but includes diacetyl. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about diacetyl and VDKs and how those things are all formed.
Yeah, so there are two principal VDKs, vicinal diketones. Diacetyl is the most important. The other one is pentanedione. The flavor threshold, the ability to detect it, is 10 times more powerful for diacetyl. So people talk about that and worry about that, but they're both important. Diacetyl smells of popcorn. It's the thing that keeps me out of movie theaters. I hate the smell of popcorn. But pentanedione, people disagree on what it smells like. Some people would say it's very similar to diacetyl. Some people say it's honey. Some people say butterscotch. But it's the same sort of, in the same sort of ballpark in terms of its aroma. Now, most people hate these in beer. But there are some advocates for them. Some people think that some of the bolder ales, with a lot of roasted character and, a lot of darker malts, they reckon a little bit of diacetyl goes a long way. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, it certainly goes a long way. But to me, I hate it. But you go to the Czech Republic, you go get yourself a nice, fresh Pilsner Urquell, and it's got a distinct diacetyl character. And that's what they want. They want some of it. So the whatever it is, you got to control it. You got to regulate it and control it every time. These two molecules, diacetyl and pentanedione, they come from precursors that are spewed out of the yeast. I like to say the yeast is incontinent when it comes to two things. One is called acetolactate, and one is called acetohydroxybutyrate. And acetolactate breaks down spontaneously in the fermenting beer to give you diacetyl, and acetohydroxybutyrate breaks down to give pentanedione. That's the bad news. The good news is the yeast will take them up again and reabsorb them. But you've got to give the yeast the opportunity to do that. And as long as you leave nice, healthy yeast in contact with the beer, that yeast will mop up the diacetyl and the pentanedione. But you've got to give the yeast the opportunity to do it. And this is one of the really great arguments for good, vigorous, healthy yeast. If you've got senile yeast and it's, you know, staggering to carry out its fermentation, then it's going to be harder and tougher to mop up the VDKs. Now you can so the yeast vigor is important. Some brewers, of course, practice a something called croisening, and croisening is where the towards the end of the fermentation, you add a very large amount of young, vigorously fermenting yeast, and that helps to mop up that diacetyl and pentanedione. When I was with Bass, we had a beer called Carling Black Label. It's still the biggest selling brand of beer in the United Kingdom. And we used to control our diacetyl and pentanedione very carefully indeed, but it didn't take weeks and weeks to do it. You know, some people think that you've got to have prolonged maturation to mop up the VDK. You really don't if you know what you're doing. And what we used to do was midway through the primary fermentation, we used to allow the temperature to rise. So we knocked off the cooling and we allowed the temperature in the fermenter to go up about 3 or 4 degrees Celsius. And what that meant was the yeast was now working faster, and it would mop up the diacetyl and the pentanedione that much faster. And so we were, I can't remember the precise amount of time we were in those fermenters, but it wasn't much more than a week. And we dealt with primary fermentation and this mopping up of the VDKs in very short order, very, very, very quickly. Now, those people who insist that you've really got to, you know, you've got to do it for a long time, but you don't. And the other thing that's important, Brad, is that if you really got to know how to measure this stuff, I realize that most people in this listening to this podcast probably don't have a gas chromatograph. I'm assuming most people don't. So you're dependent on your nostrils to detect the diacetyl and the pentanedione. What I recommend people do is take a small sample of that beer, and before you smell it, heat it up. Heat it to about 80 degrees Celsius for a few minutes. And what you're doing then is if there's any precursor left behind, the stuff that breaks down to give the diacetyl and the pentanedione, if it's still there, that heating will break it down and release the diacetyl and the pentanedione. So now you can smell them. If you don't do that, and you just say, oh, I can't detect any diacetyl and pentanedione, it's okay, and I'll get rid of the yeast, I'll get the yeast off, that any precursor that's left behind is progressively going to break down to give you the VDKs, and there's no yeast to mop it up again. So when you control these vicinal diketones, you've got to worry not only about the diacetyl and the pentanedione, you got to worry about the two things that that break down to give them as that. And that illustrates a tool that used to be applied by a Finnish brewing company called Sini Brickhoff. And what they used to do is they carry out the primary fermentation, and then they'd centrifuge off the yeast, and then they would put the beer through a heat exchanger and heat it up to, you know, from memory, around 80 degrees Celsius for several minutes. And of course, what they were doing was forcing the precursors into the free vicinal diketones. Now, most people, when they heard that they were cooking this beer, they was kind of full of horror. But what they used to do then was to cool it down again and trickle it through a column of yeast that was immobilized on the column. And that young, healthy, trapped yeast would mop up the the diacetyl and the pentandiene as the beer trickled through. So now, instead of, you know, potentially having quite long maturation times, you could actually deal with the VDKs in minutes, to speed things up.
And there's got to be other good reasons not to heat your beer to 80 degrees Celsius, though, right?
Well, there are, but I have to say this, that, you know, this beer, and the brand name was Koff, K-O-F-F, this beer actually was pretty defect-free. And the other thing you see that the yeast is doing, the yeast will get rid of some of these off flavors. So if you heat beer really strongly and you produce a lot of these so-called carbonyls and staling type compounds, which you will, the good news is the yeast will clean them up again. It'll take them away again. So, you know, the reality is they made a product which was very, very respectable and very, very drinkable. I believe the company was taken over by Carlsberg. I believe Carlsberg hated the idea, so I don't think this happens anymore. But it certainly was used to make quite a lot of commercial beer. And there's one other trick that I would mention, and that is you can actually buy a commercial enzyme. It goes by the trade name Maturex, and this is an enzyme called acetolactate decarboxylase. And what it does, you put it in the fermenter, what it does is it takes the precursor of the diacetyl, the acetolactate, and it takes away carbon dioxide, and it produces something called acetoin. Now, I hate to get all sort of biochemical, but when in a conventional fermentation, when acetolactate breaks down, we call it oxidative decarboxylation. What that means is you take carbon dioxide out and you take hydrogen out and you produce diacetyl. And what the yeast does is add the hydrogen back to make acetoin. Well, if you use acetolactate decarboxylase, you don't take away carbon dioxide and hydrogen. You just take away the carbon dioxide. So you leave the hydrogen where it is. So the acetolactate is converted to acetoin. So you bypass the diacetyl. And acetoin, you can't smell the acetoin. So using this enzyme, you avoid making the diacetyl in the first place. And that's kind of neat, I think. But, you know, there are a lot of people out there that really don't like the idea of putting commercial enzymes into brews. Personally, I've never understood that. I think it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. But you either love it or hate it, and brewing is all about opinions.
Yeah, I've noticed that. Well, let's talk about another section. Let's talk about esters, of course, which can be either good or bad. Very common in English ales, for example, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you, one of the important things that influences the ester level is the strength of the wort. So if you've got a high gravity wort, you will produce a lot of esters. So barley wines, for example, contain a lot of esters because the yeast is working hard on very high sugar levels. So that is very important. But there's two other very important, well, there's several very important things. The yeast strain is significant. Different yeast strains make different amounts of esters. But there are other things as well that are important. One of them is how much oxygen the yeast has got to play with. If the yeast is given a lot of oxygen, then it will take the building blocks and make them into the components of the membranes. It'll make a lot of yeast membranes, and it allows you to make more yeast cells, and it will grow and you get a lot of yeast production, but you get efficient fermentation. If the yeast does not have enough oxygen, it can't complete the production of those membrane components. So what happens is you build up and you accumulate the building blocks. Now, again, let's go right back to the basic biochemistry. The building block, the main one, is something called acetyl-CoA. It's basically acetic acid. And it couples together. Acetic acid has got two carbons. So if you put two of those together, you get C4. And then you get six carbon atoms. And these are the short-chain fatty acids, okay? And eventually you get to the long-chain fatty acids by building up more and more of these blocks, putting them together. And then the very last stage in making the membrane is adding oxygen. And if you add the oxygen, then you make the membrane components, the so-called unsaturated fatty acids, and the sterols. So if you don't have enough oxygen, you can't complete that process. So you get a buildup of, first of all, you get a buildup of the short-chain fatty acids, things that will give you aromas like wet dog and goat and things like that. But you also get a buildup of the acids, and they react with alcohols to form esters. So in other words, if you don't have enough oxygen, you'll produce more esters. So there's this relationship between the oxygen level and the esters. The more oxygen, the less esters. The other thing that's very, very important is, sorry, my telephone's going
off. That's okay. It happens.
Yeah.
Isn't temperature come into play as well, I think, right?
Temperature does. And the main reason temperature comes into play is the higher the temperature, the more of the alcohols you produce. An ester is produced when you react an alcohol with an acid. Mm-hmm. And that will give you an ester. So if you got ethanol, the main alcohol in beer, and you got acetic acid, you get ethyl acetate, which smells of pears. If you got isoamyl alcohol and you got acetic acid, you get isoamyl acetate, which of course smells of bananas. You got phenyl ethanol and acetic acid, you get phenyl ethyl acetate, which smells of roses. So as many alcohols as you've got and as many acids you've got that potential number of esters as well. So there are many of them. The ones that most brewers worry about are the isoamyl acetate, particularly because it's got the lowest flavor threshold, the highest detectability, and ethyl acetate or ethyl acetate. But there are others as well. Now, the alcohols, the more vigorous the fermentation, the more of those alcohols you're going to produce. So if you tend to ferment at higher temperatures, you produce more of these alcohols, which are going to spill over into the esters. So
are the higher level alcohols, right?
They call them higher alcohols. Some people call them fusel oils.
Fusel alcohols.
And some people say, well, they're responsible for headaches and hangovers. I think that's unlikely.
There could be other causes for the hangovers, possibly.
Oh yeah. Like some of the aldehydes and carbonyl compounds
or drinking too much.
They tend to go hand in hand. And the polyphenols, you know, some of those I think can cause problems, tannins. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so on the one hand, the more you promote yeast growth, the more you're going to produce these alcohols, and some of them will spill over into esters. But the esters are going to be influenced by other things to a greater extent, including the oxygen. And the other thing that's very relevant for ester production, coming back to something you were talking about earlier on, mm-hmm. is the hydrostatic pressure. The more hydrostatic pressure on the yeast, then the less ester is produced. So if you want to make a beer with a significant ester character, then you really don't want a very high hydrostatic pressure. There's two examples that I often give to the students, and I'll give them now. One is, you know, I know of one very, 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 very large brewing company, and I know of, you know, two breweries that are only within a 1,000 or 2,000 miles of one another, and one of them they have horizontal fermenters, and the other one they have deep vertical cylindrical fermenters. And the ester level coming out of the tall cylindrical vessels is significantly less than it is out of the horizontal vessels because of this hydrostatic pressure effect. And the other example, there's a wonderful brewery here in Northern California. They make a famous barley wine. They make a famous, relatively new, but still well-known Hefeweizen, and those brews, they never ferment them in cylindrical fermenters, these tall fermenters. They only ever ferment them in the square open fermenters, and that's because there's less hydrostatic pressure and therefore more esters. And in a Hefeweizen and in a barley wine, you want esters. Yeah. So
I was just going to say, we did the last episode. I told you Chris White and John Blickman were doing pressure fermentation, and they were trying to get something close to a lager. So they were using lager yeast and fermenting it under pressure, and they were able to get the ester levels down to the same level as they did at lager temperatures. at room temperature by using pressure. Obviously, they weren't able to duplicate everything, like some of the sulfur flavors and so on didn't come through, but still made a really nice beer with it.
Yes, of course. And I you see, I don't know that anybody could actually put their hand up and stand up in a court of law and actually say why pressure lowers ester levels, but it does. Foster's in Australia, they've used pressurized fermenters for a long time to keep the ester level down. So, you know, it's one of these experiential observations, but pressure certainly is extremely important when it comes to controlling esters.
Mm-hmm. Well, closely related to this, we were talking about it just a minute ago, was alcohol, which is a yeast byproduct, but one that we enjoy, but not all of them are desirable, right?
Correct. And it really depends on the style of beer, of course, and you're going to have substantially higher levels of some of these higher alcohols in certain ales than you are in lagers. The bottom line is that if you got an alcohol, you got an ester, you would worry much more about the esters than the alcohols. The esters tend to have much lower flavor thresholds than the equivalent alcohols. So you know, the flavor threshold for ethyl alcohol, ethanol, the main alcohol in beer, is really quite high. But thankfully, there's a significant amount of alcohol in any decent beer, which is above the flavor threshold, but it's still quite high. But the flavor threshold for ethyl acetate is a fraction of that of the alcohol. So, you know, the esters make much more of a contribution. The alcohols do have a role to play. The descriptors that are used for some of these alcohols, they're not particularly helpful, you know, like alcoholic, warming, this sort of thing. So they're not as well articulated, probably because they're not as important as the esters. But the bottom line with the alcohols is the more vigorous the fermentation, the more alcohol you're going to produce. So things like increasing the temperature, increasing the turbidity in the fermenter, because the turbidity is going to allow the yeast to allow the carbon dioxide to be released. We produce bubbles. The yeast moves around in the fermenter more. You get better contact to the yeast with the wort, and therefore you speed up the fermentation, and that's going to influence the alcohol level. And in turn, it's going to influence the ester level as well. So what do you got to do? You got to keep the same degree of wort clarity every time. You can't have, if you pardon the French, wort one day and crystal clear wort the next. You got to have the same degree of turbidity every time. So keep the process constant.
So let's see. The next section I read was on acids, and I actually found that pretty interesting. You know, can you tell us, for example, how fatty acids are created and how they create problems in your finished beer?
Yeah, like I was saying earlier on, they're progressively built up from the building blocks. So, yeah, I urge the listeners to come do a class with me at Davis, 1 week class before I drop off this mortal coil. But what happens is the yeast makes a substance called pyruvic acid, and lots of things hinge around the pyruvic acid. For example, it goes to acetaldehyde and therefore goes to alcohol. So that's one route. Pyruvate also goes to make acetolactate, which is going to break down and give you diacetyl. So that's another thing that happens to it. The pyruvic acid also goes into the so-called Krebs cycle, tricarboxylic acid cycle, by way of something called acetyl-CoA. And certain acids are made in that, like citric acid. But the acetyl-CoA, or the acetic acid, the CoA is just a carrier. It carries it. So it's acetic acid, basically, in an activated form. It's got two carbon atoms, and what happens is two of them react together, so you get four carbon atoms now. So that's butyric acid, which will smell kind of buttery. And then you put on another two, and you get hexanoic acid. I can't remember off the top of my head what that smells of, but I can tell you that octanoic acid, which has got eight carbon atoms, smells of goats, and so on. So these short-chain fatty acids are built up in this way. And they're very much dependent on the yeast strain again, but they are very much dependent on, like I said earlier on the amount of oxygen. If you get a lot of oxygen, then they're going to get mopped up. They're going to be converted into still longer chains that are not going to have these undesirable flavors, or desirable flavors, depending on the beer that you want. But if you get an accumulation of them, for example, by not having enough oxygen, then you will develop some of these characteristics. So it really does depend on the yeast strain, and if you want to regulate them at a certain level, define what that process is that gives you the preferred level of these and all the other flavor components. But hopefully, the way I've just described that illustrates the fact that all these things are interrelated, you know? So this pyruvic acid, going in all these different directions. And so some of it goes to alcohol, and some of it goes to acetyl-CoA, and some of it goes to acetylactate. You know, how do you apportion which goes in which direction? And the answer is, you choose your yeast, you choose the age of the yeast, you choose the vigor of the yeast, you control the vigor of the yeast and the health of the yeast, you put in the right amount into the right wort, the right temperature, in the right vessel, and specify those conditions. And then that's where the art comes in. We can explain the science individually for each of these individual molecules, but the point is they are interrelated. And if you focus on one and say, well, I need to increase the level of that, if you're not careful, it'll bite you in the posterior and you'll find that something else changes. You know, going back to what I said.
You are making a really strong case for aeration, though, getting enough oxygen into the wort, right?
Getting enough oxygen for the yeast to be able to multiply. If you don't have enough oxygen at one extreme, you're going to have a stuck fermentation. If you put in too much oxygen, you are going to produce more yeast. And, you know, the carbon's got to go somewhere. It goes ultimately, the bulk of it goes either into yeast cells or into alcohol. So the more oxygen you give the yeast, the more yeast you're going to produce, and a little bit less alcohol. Now, if you're running the Dog's Posterior Brewing Company, and you're brewing a bucket a week, it doesn't really matter. But if you are the world's biggest brewing company, they're meticulous in controlling the oxygen to very, very precise levels, because if they grow a lot of yeast, that means that the amount of beer they produce has significantly decreased. So, you know, how much do you give it? Ideally, exactly the right amount. If you're going to err on the side of anything, I would say err on the side of more oxygen rather than less, because the last thing you want is a stuck fermentation. But the important thing is you got to control these things. Going back to something I said earlier on, Brad, I said that in Bass, we used to allow the temperature to rise midway through the fermentation. And the way we did that, the reason we did it was to control the VDKs. Hopefully, the listeners will realize that if you do that, then you are going to tend to produce somewhat more higher alcohols. But the important thing is that was built into the process for fermenting Carling Black Label. So it was all part of the process. But if you suddenly say you're making a certain type of beer and you say, oh, I'm going to start giving it a free temperature rise midway through the fermentation, then you've got to be very mindful of the fact that actually you might just start increasing your alcohol levels and therefore possibly semester levels as well. So you can't just do it on a whim. And that's why, like I said, you know, what seems like an eternity ago now, once you've decided what you want to make and how you're going to make it, stick at it. And if you change, you're going to run the risk of changing the flavor.
Well, I think we got time for maybe one more. Let's talk about sulfur, which many of us very closely associate with lager fermentation. Certainly one of the strongest aroma compounds we pick up from yeast. Can you tell us about sulfur?
Well, any molecule that's got sulfur in it tends to be a bit whiffy. Sulfur-containing substances have got extremely low flavor thresholds, very easy to detect. So there are a bunch of these. You know, there are a bunch of mercaptans, which give you sort of rubbery flavors and vegetable flavors. There's methyl thioacetate, which gives you kind of a cabbagey flavor. The two that most brewers talk about is hydrogen sulfide and dimethyl sulfide, DMS. H2S, you know, it's a no-no in most beers, but not all. So if you go to Burton-on-Trent, and have a classic Burton ale, let's say a pint of Marston's Pedigree, you expect a little bit of sulfur on the nose, a little bit of hydrogen sulfide. There's a two-word descriptor for that, which I can't use in polite society in this country. It's okay in England, but it's not in this country.
That's okay. It's a clean show, so.
Yeah. So I won't say it. But if you go to the Oxford Companion to Beer, then you'll find an entry at the Burton something. But that's hydrogen sulfide. A little bit of hydrogen sulfide is wanted there. Most beers not. The way to prevent having excessive hydrogen sulfide is to make sure your fermentation is vigorous. You have a vigorous fermentation. The yeast is working vigorously. All the carbon dioxide will wash away that hydrogen sulfide. Now, in the world of wine, of course, they don't have very vigorous fermentation, so they do tend to have a significant problem with hydrogen sulfide. The way many of them solve it is to add copper sulfate. Mm-hmm. And a little bit of copper will bind the hydrogen sulfide and take it out of harm's way. I might have used this story on your show before, but I remember one guy in Bass coming into my office one day when I was a QA manager saying, look at this. And it was the beer was blue. And I said, what's that? He said, well, you're the smart ass PhD. You tell me. All I know is I've just had a pint and it was good. And what he'd done is miscalculate and added far, far too much copper sulfate to mop up the hydrogen sulfide in this beer that tended to have too much hydrogen sulfide. So he had his stomach pumped and we stopped using copper. A little bit of copper.
Didn't you tell me before, though, that this was a couple episodes back, but you told me that copper can have some negative impacts on the long-term storage, right?
Yeah, copper is very, 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 very bad news for flavor stability. If you do feel you need to use it to mop up too much hydrogen sulfide in a beer, then about 0.1 milligrams per liter or part per million is the way to go. Some people actually have a little bit of copper pipe or a little welded copper plate in the gleaming stainless steel brewery just to leach enough copper into the wort to mop up the hydrogen sulfide. But it is bad news for flavor stability. DMS comes from the malt ultimately. There's a precursor in the malt. It's called SMM. And it breaks down due to heat. And if there's SMM in the malt, it's broken down in the boil. And if you have vigorous boil and a prolonged boil, this precursor SMM is broken down to DMS and it goes zooming up the chimney, up the stack, and it's lost. But if you don't break all of it down, you go into the whirlpool stand, and any SMM that survives, it's hot enough in the whirlpool, the hot work receiver, to break down the SMM, but it's not turbulent, so the DMS stays behind.
Yeah, and I've run into a number of commercial breweries that don't have a really good stack set up either.
Correct.
And I've seen cases where it actually, they got a cold stack coming out of the boiler, and it basically just runs back down the inside of the ventilation shaft, basically.
Correct.
Right back into the pot.
Correct. And if you don't have a vigorous boil, and it's like a simmer, then the DMS just stays behind. But a huge amount of DMS can come from this source. But the other source is the yeast. And what the yeast does, it will take away the oxygen from something called dimethyl sulfoxide. And Brian Annis and I were the first people to show this back in 1979. How long ago is that? It is time I retired. And we found that there's DMSO that is produced during the kilning in the malt. And this DMSO, which is very heat resistant, it just dissolves in the wort and it goes into the fermentation and the yeast will convert the DMSO, take off the O and make DMS. And this is a significant source of DMS. And it's the ability of yeast to make DMS is very much dependent on the temperature. The lower the temperature, the more DMS will be made by the yeast. And the other very important thing is the shape of the fermenter. Again, if you've got a lot of purging with CO2, like a shallow fermenter, you're going to purge off the DMS much more than in a deep vessel, a cylinder conical vessel, and this DMS is just going to stay behind to a greater extent. If you analyze how much carbon dioxide comes off a fermenter, the main contaminant is DMS. And so it looks on paper like, there's a lot of DMS in the wort and there's much less in the beer. And therefore people naively say, well, that the DMS is all coming from the wort. It's a balance. It's a balance between how much DMS is lost with the fermentation gases and how much new DMS is made by the yeast. And as I say, it is dependent on the yeast strain. It's dependent on the temperature, as I've said, and also dependent on how much amino acids you've got, how much free amino nitrogen. If your yeast is hurting for amino acids, it will tend to produce more DMS. There was a study back in the day in Leuven in Belgium by the forerunner of InBev, Interbrew, and of course their flagship brand was Stella Artois. And what they showed was that 80% of the DMS in that beer actually comes from yeast metabolism, from yeast converting DMSO into DMS. So it is something you can't ignore. And again, how do you control it? To sound like a broken record now, you control the process and the yeast strain and the age of the yeast and how much yeast you put in and what the wort is, what the temperature is, what fermenter you're using and so on. Then you'll get control.
Well, Charlie, do you have any final advice on managing yeast to reduce the off flavors in your beer? It sounds like a lot of it's common sense, but can you go over a few of the key points again?
Well, as I say, and it certainly is, and now has become a broken record. What you have to do is specify your yeast strain, look after that yeast, make sure it's in prime condition, ensure its viability, pitch it at the right level, pitch it into wort of a consistent gravity and a consistent clarity, control the oxygen level that you're giving to that yeast, control the clarity of the wort, control the fermentation vessel, control all those parameters. And if you give that wort, the same wort, to the same yeast, day in, day out, it should produce, under the same conditions, the flavor spectrum that you want.
Awesome, Charlie. Well, thank you again for coming on the show. Really appreciate you being here.
Always a pleasure. Keep asking me.
I will. I'm hoping to get your email before you retire, whatever your personal email is. We can run Skype from the house, can't you?
Yeah. It'll be the same email.
It'll be the same. Okay, we'll be able to track you down then.
Whether the university charged me for it or not, I don't know.
You never know these days.
I don't know whether it's one of the perks of retirement or not. Who knows?
Make it part of your retirement contract or plan.
Yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, something like that.
Well, again, today my guest was Dr. Charlie Bamforth. He's professor of brewing and malting science at the University of California, Davis. He's author of the ASBC Handbook on Flavor, as well as I don't know how many other books, probably 20-something other books, right, Charlie?
About that, including the one on soccer goalkeepers.
Goalkeepers, that's my favorite, personally. Well, thanks again for coming on the show. Appreciate it, Charlie.
Pleasure.
Well, a big thank you to Dr. Charlie Bamforth for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Their educational program lets you learn about every aspect of brewing in detail. Take advantage of their fantastic sale and get 20% off any of their courses when you use the offer code BEERSMITH2017 at learn.beerandbrewing.com. And also Blickman Engineering, creators of the innovative new BrewVision wireless thermometer. Remotely monitor your brewing system from your iPhone or iPad, record data, set alerts, and grab recipes directly from BeerSmith. The BrewVision thermometer, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, BeerSmith software, the industry standard for home and professional brewers. It lets you design great beer recipes and brew with confidence. Download your free 21-day trial from beersmith.com today. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.